Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Great pleasure to welcome Professor Richard Epstein. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago at the Hoover Institution. To help me understand the new sitting of the Supreme Court just passed, and one particular case that has heard that has been demonstrated in oral argument and will have a decision, we presume, in the springtime. Garland versus Vanderstock. The question, whether, quote, a weapons parts kit that is designed to or may readily be completed, assembled, restored, or otherwise converted to expel a projectile by the action of an explosive under, and then a series of laws, is a firearm, in quotes, regulated by the Gun Control Act of 1968, and two, whether, quote, a partially complete, disassembled, or non-functional frame or receiver, end quote, that is, quote, designed to or may readily be completed, assembled, restored, or otherwise converted to function as a frame or receiver under the same law is a frame or receiver regulated by the Gun Control Act of 1968. Richard, a very good day to you, and this is the ghost gun law. And the headlines say that the court, which we're told is conservative, is very much in line to keep this the ghost gun non-permitted under the Gun Control Act of 1968. What is the story here, Richard? Ghost gun, it caught my attention, but I got lost as I read about it. Good evening.
Well, it turns out if you look at that statute, it's a rambling discourse which is designed to be relatively comprehensive. The question about this is, in a technical way, whether or not you could just assemble the kit, or whether or not what you have to do in your home is to drill a hole in some piece in order to complete the assembly. And the theory is on the part of the Vanderstocken is this thing cannot be assembled unless there's additional work done downstream by the owner, and so therefore it's not covered by the statute. I have to say I regard the article as totally useless. This is a serious issue. Everybody understands why it is that you impose licensing requirements and embedding these serial numbers on guns, because you have to be able to trace them. And if you can trace them, it improves the odds of capturing. So now what's happening is what they do is they put a kit. And it's not that you put it together, but you have to do some minor manipulation. This is a standard act of circumvention. And since the actions that are required to complete this are utterly trivial and banal, the answer is that the statute ought to apply. And in fact, this is an essay in statutory construction. And the first rule of statutory construction is, first you find out what the core meaning is, and then you ask yourself whether somebody is engaged in a certain kind of activity which is designed to circumvent the particular statute, even though it's so close to the things that are prescribed that it's a perfect substitute for them. And the general rule on interpretation has always been, when you get those kinds of cases, what you do is you have a penumbra and you put those statutes in there and you cover them. This goes back, as I always like to say, to Roman law, when you start off with a statute that says you can't kill somebody with a knife. And then what somebody does is comes up with the bright idea of putting poison in front of somebody so that they could drink it. And the question is, can you hold them liable under the statute? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. But what you do is you find out that furnishing a cause of death is an analogous case close enough that it's going to be treated as though it's the real thing. And that's what's going to happen here. One of the things you would then want to ask about this case is the bullet that did not drop. Did anybody make a Second Amendment argument saying, in effect, that your right to keep and bear arms allows you to escape the registration? And the Second Amendment, if you read the summaries of the case, is nowhere in evidence in this case. Because, in fact, if Congress had managed to plug this hole with an explicit warning, and you only had the Second Amendment, not the authorization charge, there is not a person in the world who would say that you can treat this thing as though it's an illegitimate police power regulation, because then you would have to take the serial numbers off all of the weapons that are out there. And then think about it this way. If you really believe in this, then what you have to do is take serial numbers off of cars. After all, somebody could chase down a car and do it for an illicit reason. What happens is when you're dealing with serial numbers, licenses, or any advanced system of registration and so forth, is you take the chance that there'll be a small number of cases where the system will be used, and then you try to correct them after the fact. But you don't simply invalidate the entire system, because the errors in the other direction are really hard. And so you listen to these bereft police chiefs talking, and you say, of course they're right. What they're saying is, if we have a serial number on a gun, we could get a very high percentage of leads and often get the person. But if you take the serial number off, we're absolutely hopeless, and 99%+ of those cases go unsolved. Well, a person is every bit as dead by an unlicensed gun as they are by a licensed gun, with or without a serial. And so I am pretty confident that the Supreme Court is going to uphold the particular statute. That was the drift of the oral argument. And I hope they do so, because one of the things that I disagree with many conservatives is the way in which they do textualism. And I put this in part on Nino Scalia, who is much too textual and much too literal. I come from a very different tradition of statutory construction, going back to the early days, in which there is always understood around any particular statute a series of general propositions that apply unless they're expressly negated. And one of those situations is no circumvention, no workaround is to be tolerated. If, in fact, the thing that is done is virtually equivalent to the thing that's prohibited, you stop it. And then what you do is you worry about what remedies you're going to give and what defenses you're going to allow to this statute. So I assume if somebody did not put a serial number on one of these kits because somebody was standing over him with a gun to his head and said, if you do this, I'm going to kill you, he would have a defense. These are not plausible scenarios in cases of this sort. So I would say that the odds are over 90% that this case will come out with the regulation being upheld. I believe it was Republicans who put some of these bills in place to begin with. And so I just don't even see why there's any reason to think that a liberal conservative split would have any relevance to play in this particular kind of case. And so I like the word ghost gun. I looked at the statute, and like you, got a headache when I try to read it aloud. But I'm pretty sure that when the Supreme Court does it, the clerks will understand what's going on, and they will basically strike it down. My prediction is it will be 9-0.
A detail about what happens in oral arguments. It was argued by the Solicitor General Preligar, I believe.
Yes.
You have taught me, Richard, over the years, not to be persuaded by the oral argument response from the court, that oftentimes they take positions that are not consistent with where they're going, but they want to see if the petitioner has adequate preparation for all of the possibilities ahead. Mm-hmm. They're not doing discovery. They've got a fixed case. Doesn't that mean that the presumption that the court will continue the regulation is based on guesswork, that just because they asked questions that were consistent doesn't mean that's the way they're going to vote?
Well, no, it depends on what the tone of voice they have, strangely enough. Sometimes they are trying to play gotcha, and if they give the right answer to a hostile question, it's great. But that's not the tenor that was reported by Amy Howe, and I didn't listen to the full testimony. It was a kind of incredulity that you guys are putting this stuff forward. And I think, in effect, that that's a pretty good spirometer of where they're going. And if you start looking back at most of the other cases where there are arguments, if there's a real point of principle, you will see a kind of jousting between the conservative and the liberal members of the court, taking in the form of the questions that they ask. So nothing is more common than to hear a very hostile question to a conservative person by Elena Kagan, who has a nice ability to kind of expose somebody else's weaknesses. And I think most of the time when she asks the question and then writes her opinion, what she said in the question is what she writes down there. So I think that's reading a little bit too much to it in this particular case. There are cases in which you're genuinely uncertain and you try to ask probing questions of both things in order to help you what's going on. But I think the general rule that most people now start to say is that the oral argument is less important in shaping the case than it used to be, except in very rare circumstances. And I'll give you another reason, which I think this is true. You take a case like this and ask yourself the number of amicus curiae briefs that are going to be put forward, friend of the court's briefs, and who's going to write them. And when you've got that, you've got so much more information on the paper record from both sides, and that it's not just one brief and an oral argument. It's 20 briefs on both sides and an oral argument. And the sheer rate of the amicus stuff is serious. And amicus briefs are extremely important in modern judicial practice for two reasons. One, sometimes there's an amicus who states something that the principal party don't stress or don't get right. And so judges will pay very close attention to them in what's going on. And also what happens is there is signaling function. So if you have a bunch of prominent organizations that say we're in favor of this and we're against that and so forth, it's going to weigh on the court independent of what the brief says. The most famous illustration of that is the Grutter case, in which Sandra Day O'Connor made the false prediction that all this affirmative action issues will be in the past. And what she did is she cited two extremely influential briefs, one by the military people and one by the CEO. And they both said, we can't live in a colorblind world of the sort that they want in that case. And that was the thing that basically shifted her over. Because what she did is she found there were major constituents who basically were opposed to all of this stuff. And you have to remember, she was a judge, to be sure, but she was also in charge of the Arizona legislature before she went on the intermediate court in Arizona. And so I think, in effect, that there's lots of signaling stuff going on here. And my own guess is that in this particular case, Ms. Prolegar had a very easy time of it, and she did a very good job from the snippets that I read in the oral argument. She's good at arguing a case from strength, and she argued a case for which there was no serious Republican opposition. I mean, just ask yourself as a political matter, who's going to come out and say, I don't know what this statute says, but I think it's a really important social policy to have these ghost guns out there. Nobody's going to say that, and that's going to influence the Supreme Court, and it means that they will put into place the anti-circumvention principle that I talked about a moment ago.
Speaking with Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, about the oral argument of a case, Garland versus Vanderstock, to be decided, we can presume, in the year 2025. We're going to turn now to the year 2024 right now. The unclear situation in the Middle East remains a threat to everything, the election, the economies of the world, and our allies. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This Labor Day, say goodbye to spills, stains, and overpriced furniture with WashableSofas.com. Featuring Anabay, the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly pricing. Sofas start at just $6.99, making it the perfect time to upgrade your space. Anabay's pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and interchangeable slip covers are made with high-performance fabric built for real life. You'll love the cloud-like comfort of hypoallergenic, high-resilience foam that never needs fluffing, and a durable steel frame that stands the test of time. With modular pieces, you can rearrange any time. It's a sofa that adapts to your life. Now through Labor Day, get up to 60% off site-wide at WashableSofas.com. Every order comes with a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping, no restocking fees, every penny back. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.